IB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Ayatollah Khamenei approves amnesty and a commutation of sentences for a large number of people detained during the recent riots in Iran. Syria slams U.S.'s hostile policy, saying Washington and its allies use the same lies against Damascus that they used before in invading Iraq. And a senior Ukrainian lawmaker says the country's defense minister will be replaced following corruption scandals ahead of expected Russian offensive. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisoum Shahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. Now, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has pardoned and commuted the sentences of a large number of people arrested during the recent riots in the country. Ayatollah Khamenei issued the decree in response to a request by the Iranian judiciary on the occasion of the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. In his request, Ghulam Hossein Mohseni Eje said many of those who committed crimes during the foreign-backed riots are now repentant and ask for forgiveness. Cases against those charged with crimes or convicted of them will now be dropped. The judiciary chief, however, said the clemency will not apply to those who committed espionage, murder, bodily harm, and vandalism. Those facing lawsuits by private litigations are not eligible for amnesty either. Ayatollah Khamenei has also granted amnesty to a number of people convicted of other crimes. Human rights activist Firas al-Najim from Canada says amnesties on such a mass scale and regular basis are a mark of humane and merciful system, which is rare in Western countries.
I never hear in Canada them having any amnesty or pardons on a mass amount of people in Christmas or any different type of time, even holy times, right? There is certain cases where they probably pardon certain things maybe, or they're more lenient on a certain sentence or so on, but that's just, you know, case by case. But this is on a high level, on a big level, and this is not the first time. I mean, the Islamic Republic of Iran has done that on several occasions, especially holy times or Nowruz or things like that. You know, and I think this really shows Iran and the just system that the Iran does really have. All these things into consideration. I mean, the people that were writing, some of them maybe were upset because of the high inflations, the sanctions, and so on, and their emotions got played together. And they went out there and they made some mistakes, and they joined these rallies and committed some crimes. And now look, they're looking into that and saying that, you know, some of them have repented, some of them have said that they made mistakes. So now they're letting them go, or they're lessening their sentences. But at the same time, they are holding the ones accountable that were spying for foreign countries, the ones that were stabbing police officers, the ones that were killing.
Iran and Cuba are two major victims of U.S. unilateral sanctions as well as interference. So when the two top diplomats of the countries met in Havana, they poured much scorn on U.S. imperialistic and interventionist policies. We discuss this in our news review program.
Iran's foreign minister says U.S. bullying and sanctions policy are doomed to failure. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in a meeting with his Cuban counterpart in Havana. The top Iranian diplomat reaffirmed Tehran's condemnation of foreign meddling in Cuba's affairs and the U.S. role in the 2021 riots in Caribbean country. Also referring to the recent unrest in Iran, Amir Abdollahian said the U.S. and some other Western states target sovereign countries by simultaneously posing sanctions on them and provoking riots there. The Cuban foreign minister, for his part, also denounced unilateral sanctions and foreign interference. Bruno Rodriguez said enhancing ties with Iran is a priority for his country. Amir Abdollahian also earlier met with the Cuban president. He's on a foreign tour, which has already taken him to Mauritania, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. Now let's bring in Daniel Schott, Latin American expert from Munich, who joins us. We also have Joe Emers Berger, writer and political commentator, joining us from Windsor. I'd like to welcome to you both. And Daniel Shaw, if I may start with you. When you take a look at the common viewpoints that, for example, Iran and Cuba have in this case, since it's the most recent visit by the Iranian foreign minister, you can see that the approach is going to be pretty much the same when it comes to the Western world, particularly the U.S., actually. Are we seeing a trend here? Because this kind of mirrors the same thing that has happened to Venezuela. And, of course, Iran has also, the foreign minister visited Venezuela. So we're looking at the same approaches here, aren't we?
That's exactly correct. The U.S.'s preferred weapon of war nowadays are sanctions, are an economic war to try to bring the populace of Iran, of China, of Russia, of Nicaragua, of Cuba, of Venezuela, of these different countries that they cannot economically and militarily and diplomatically control. They want to bring them to their knees. So what we are witnessing is an organic axis of the blockaded. We're seeing Tehran reach out to Caracas, and we're seeing Caracas reach out to Moscow, and Moscow reach out to Beijing to thwart these sanctions. We're seeing the sanctions still have an incredible human impact. Some 8 million Venezuelans have been forced from their homeland. Some 40,000 Venezuelans were killed from the sanctions in 2017. But the different blockaded countries are searching for ways to circumvent these sanctions and work with one another in humane ways so that they can transcend these foreign impositions from the U.S.
Well, Joe Emersberger, if we're taking a look at the fact that countries that are aligned together in this respect, like Iran and Cuba and Venezuela, and perhaps we can put Nicaragua in there, or any other countries that are sanctioned by the U.S., this long arm of U.S. sanctions is one of the things that are binding these countries together. Are we looking, and this is not something new in terms of trying to stop that. Are we looking at the shift to already be in motion, and therefore, when you see these countries enhancing their trade relations in particular, that they are going to be successful, and it's the U.S. that's going to be somewhat watching from the sidelines?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be overconfident either, but it's certainly true that this is bringing countries together as for survival to offset the monstrously murderous impact of U.S. sanctions. And I would add, it's also bringing together countries that aren't officially sanctioned, like Brazil. I mean, even very moderate figures could make an argument that's kind of a very timid argument to say, well, if you're very inefficient, if Brazil wants to trade with Argentina, that they have to go through bank accounts in the United States. I mean, that's kind of silly, right? Why can't they just set up a payment system that bypasses the U.S. entirely? I mean, you can make an argument just in terms of economic efficiency, if that makes sense. But what's not said is obviously why do you want to empower Washington to one day sanction you as well? They'll just add anybody to their list of countries that they're trying to destroy based on any pretext, no matter how ridiculous. So even the countries that aren't officially sanctioned are showing that they want to bypass the United States, even if they aren't putting it that blunt.
Okay, thank you so much, Daniel Shaw, an American expert from Munich. And also, Joe Emersberger, thank you, writer and political commentator, spoke to us on the phone from Windsor, Ontario. And that is it for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
The ninth meeting of the Joint Economic Cooperation Committee of Iran and Zimbabwe wrapped up its work in Tehran. The meeting has provided a platform for developing economic cooperation and improving the level of trade exchanges between the two countries. Saman Kutri reports.
The closing session of the ninth meeting of the Joint Economic Cooperation Committee of Iran and Zimbabwe was held in Tehran. During the meeting, the two sides stressed the importance of bilateral cooperation in the fields of agriculture, health, and facilitating exports of Iranian drugs into the Zimbabwean market. Iran and Zimbabwe officials agreed to use Iran's experiences in various fields, including the development of small and medium-sized enterprises, energy, and science.
Agriculture, exports of machinery, sale of petrochemical products, and technical engineering services are among the existing capacities for broader cooperation between Iran and Zimbabwe.
Speaking at the meeting, Iran's Minister of Cooperatives, Labor and Social Welfare, Solat Mortazavi, said that the current level of commercial and economic relations between the two sides should increase to at least $500 million per year based on high potentials of the two countries.
The current level of commercial and economic relations between the two countries is not satisfactory, and the two countries should use their capacities to increase their volume of bilateral trade to at least $500 million per year. Zimbabwe has been under sanctions for almost 20 years, and Iran can share its experiences with Zimbabwe in various fields, including neutralizing the existing sanctions of the West.
Addressing the meeting, the visiting Zimbabwe's Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, Makamura Shava, said mutual ties with Iran is taken to be very significant for Zimbabwe, stressing the country will definitely enjoy bilateral friendly ties with the Islamic Republic.
Zimbabwe and Iran are like twins who must learn to cooperate, because both countries have been slammed with sanctions by the West. And in this regard, the West hoped that Iran would go to its knees, Zimbabwe would go to its knees, but thank God this has not happened. So we are here to make sure that we turn the fortunes round and to say that these sanctions which the West imposed on us can be a blessing in disguise.
At the end of the meeting, several memoranda of understanding were signed by the two sides. According to Iranian officials, sanctions have become an opportunity to enhance production and improve human resources productivity, and that Iran is ready to transfer know-how and develop Zimbabwe's energy, transportation, tourism, medicine, and mining sectors. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Syrian foreign minister says the U.S. and some of its European allies are hatching the same plot against his country that they did 20 years ago for Iraq. In a Twitter post, Firas al-Maghdad referred to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003 on the pretext that it possessed weapons of mass destruction. He said that then U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell staged a scene of manipulation and lies in the UN Security Council to justify the invasion. Maghdad said Powell used America's own satellite images and documents on Iraq's WMD, which later turned out to be non-existent. He added that everything Powell put forward were mere unsubstantiated lies, which he himself acknowledged later. The top Syrian diplomat warned that the U.S. and its allies, namely France and Germany and the U.K., are trying to use a similar pretext to interfere in other countries' affairs. The Ukrainian defense minister will be replaced by the country's head of intelligence following a series of corruption scandals within the ministry. A senior Ukrainian lawmaker said the minister will head the defense ministry, calling for a reshuffle, which is absolutely logical in wartime. He underlined that the circumstances require reinforcement and regrouping. The legislator added that the government will continue such policy in the future, as Russia is preparing to advance further and Ukrainian forces are preparing to defend the nation. The minister was appointed in November 2021. He helped secure Western weapons to boost the country's defense, but his ministry has been beset by corruption scandals. The ministry has been accused of signing food contracts at prices 2 to 3 times higher than the current rates for basic foodstuffs. Several U.S. Republican lawmakers have criticized President Joe Biden for waiting days to shoot down a suspected Chinese spy balloon that had entered into American airspace. Member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Tom Cotton, said the military should never have allowed the balloon to transit the entire continental United States. He accused Biden of aiming to salvage Secretary of State Antony Blinken's planned trip to Beijing. Separately, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee said the balloon traveled unhindered over sensitive nuclear missile sites. Mike Turner said China was using the balloon to gain information on how to defeat the command and control America's nuclear weapons and missile defense systems. Vice Chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Marco Rubio, made similar accusations, saying that China was trying to send a message that it could enter U.S. airspace. An Air Force fighter jet shot down the balloon off the coast of South Carolina on Saturday. Earlier, we talked to political analyst Kinto Shu from Beijing. He tells us the U.S. Shooting down the Chinese balloon could set a dangerous precedent and prompt retaliatory measures.
Well, obviously, this is an incident. The airship is out of control. It's unmanned. And it's because of the strong westerly, or the strong wind, basically, blowing to the from the east to the west. And it went astray and deviated from due course severely and straight into the U.S. airspace. The Chinese side has expressed regret and explaining that this is for research purpose, meteorological research in particular. And usually, such an incident, which is not unusual in the history of between countries, let's say, in international relations, but usually it was dealt with by two governments and or by professionals from both sides, because it is not a, it's not a serious issue, but it's a sovereignty issue. I think we should have there's overreaction, and also in a sense it is a bit aggressive, I would say, by shooting down the balloon even after the explanation from the Chinese side, because remember this could be a precedent. Because there's a lot of U.S. military assets flying close or in direct violation of the Chinese sovereign airspace in the South China Sea, in the East China Sea, over Taiwan, for example. If China chooses to retaliate, they can do something like this. So let's hope that they will talk to each other and find a way out of this difficult situation.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. In the United States, the seven states that rely on the drought-stricken Colorado River failed to meet a 31st of January federal deadline to strike a deal on voluntarily cutting their water use. After negotiations reached a standstill, six of the seven states, namely Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming, submitted a consensus-based modeling alternative. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story, Please stay with us. The website of CNBC has covered this story and tells us more. The seven states that rely on the drought-stricken Colorado River failed to meet a 31st of January federal deadline to strike a deal on voluntarily cutting water use, an impasse that could eventually prompt the Biden administration to impose cuts as the western United States grapples with a historic drought and record low reservoir levels. After negotiations reached a standstill, six of the seven states dependent on the Colorado River instead submitted a proposal to the Bureau of Reclamation that outlined ways to reduce water use and factored in water that's lost because of evaporation and leaky infrastructure. The proposal, titled the Consensus-Based Modeling Alternative, was jointly submitted by Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. The proposal notably excluded California, the largest user of the Colorado River water, which supplies water to 40 million people. Officials said the state will release its own plan. The six states' document outlined an approach to help protect Glen Canyon Dam and Hoover Dam infrastructure, water deliveries and power production, and prevent the Colorado River's reservoirs from reaching Deadpool, which happens when water drops to a level so low that it can't move downstream from the dam. The Colorado River has long been over-allocated, but climate change has worsened drought conditions in the region and reservoir levels have plummeted over the past couple of decades. As the western United States experienced its driest two decades in at least 1,200 years, water levels in the country's two largest reservoirs, that is Lake Mead and Lake Powell, have reached record lows. Sarah Porter, director of the Kyle Center for Water Policy at Arizona State University, said the state's proposal appeared to be a very sincere commitment to advance negotiations over water cuts and keep reservoirs from falling to dangerously low levels. It's easy to overlook how difficult and complex this is for every single state, Sarah Porter said. We have to take less water out of the system, and these are the hardest negotiations to do. Water officials emphasized the proposal was not an official agreement between states, but rather a critical step towards protecting the Colorado River and eventually reaching a seven-state agreement. This modeling proposal is a key step in the ongoing dialogue among seven basin states, as we continue to seek a collaborative solution to stabilize the Colorado River system. Tom Buschatzke, director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources, said in a statement. However, the failure to reach a deal marks the second time in the past 6 months that the seven states using Colorado River water have missed the deadline to agree on cuts under the Interior Department, which manages flows on the river. Historically, states have been the ones to figure out how to share the Colorado River water. But a failure to reach an agreement on reductions could place the responsibility on the federal government. The Biden administration has urged the seven states to save between 2 million and 4 million acre-feet of water, or up to a third of the river's average flow. For comparison, California is entitled to use 4.4 million acre-feet of river water per year, and Arizona is entitled to use 2.8 million acre-feet of water per year. An acre-foot of water is about what two average households consume each year. So far, Arizona has taken the brunt of the government's water reductions, particularly the state's farmers, who grow produce in the desert and use nearly three-quarters of the available water supply to irrigate their crops. The alternative outlined by the six states proposes water cuts that would nearly reach the lower end of 2 million acre-feet that federal officials have urged, with nearly all of the mandatory cuts focused on Arizona, California, and Nevada. The proposal also calls for imposing voluntary conservation measures in Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. Becky Mitchell, director of the Colorado Water Conservation Board, said this approach appropriately distributes the burden across the basin and provides safeguards for the tribes, for water users, and environmental values in the upper basin. The Bureau of Reclamation is set to release in March a draft of its proposal on how it operates Glen Canyon and Hoover Dams and will consider the six states' letter as part of that plan. The Associated Press has also covered this story and tells us more. Six western states have agreed on a plan to dramatically cut their water intake from the Colorado River, but California is the lone holdout. Six western states that rely on water from the Colorado River have agreed on a model to dramatically cut their use, months after the federal government called for action and an initial deadline passed. California, with the largest allocation of water from the Colorado River, is the lone holdout. The Colorado River and its tributaries pass through seven states and into Mexico, serving 40 million people and a $5 billion a year agricultural industry. Some of the largest cities in the United States, including the cities of Los Angeles, Phoenix, Denver, and Las Vegas, two Mexican states, Native American tribes, and others, depend on the Colorado River that's been severely stressed by drought, by high demand and overuse. States missed the mid-August deadline to heed the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation's call to propose ways to conserve 2 million to 4 million acre-feet of water. They regrouped to reach consensus by the end of January to fold into a larger proposal Reclamation has in the works. Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming sent a letter on Monday, 30th of January, to Reclamation, which operates the major dams in the river system, to outline an alternative that builds on existing guidelines, deepens water cuts, and factors in water that's lost through evaporation and transportation. California, however, did not sign onto Monday's agreement, but released a proposal back in October to cut 400,000 acre-feet of water. An acre-foot is enough water to supply 2 to 3 U.S. households for a year. Tina Shields, water manager for California's Imperial Irrigation District, the single largest user of Colorado River water, declined to comment on Monday under basin-wide discussions. But she said any multi-state agreement must be legally defensible. Tina Shields said, frankly, that's what the priority system was set up for, to make long-term planning decisions. We have done so in California and looking to solve a larger Colorado River drought by pointing at those with senior water rights isn't fair. Nothing will happen immediately with the consensus reached among the six states. However, not reaching a consensus carried the risk of having the federal government alone determine how to eventually impose cuts to water use. By not signing on the deal, California doesn't avoid that risk.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to The Viewpoint. I'm Beta, the host of today's episode. And today with me, I have two dear guests, experts of today's episode. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Brother, and assalamu alaikum, brother Muhammad.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you very much for having me once again.
Yeah, it's a pleasure for me to have you here with me. So, I'm a woman here, and you both are from the opposite gender, so we're going to have a lot of problem with this discussion with each other, but the thing I'm going to tell you is that the leader of the Islamic Revolution, I have a quote that tells the main responsibility of a woman is household chores. You know, but for example, as a girl in this world, I have my own mindset that I'm telling that, okay, I'm going to be a doctor here because I'm a medicine student. Mm-hmm. And in this way, I want to put my all effort in that major. I mean, I want to be here for this, only in this, and I have only this goal. You know, I don't have enough time, for example, for, I don't know, homemaking or something. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want to spend my time. This is my time. Yes, I am who decides about this and how to spend it. So I'm going to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, but always there are some people who tries to convince me, no, for example, after 50 years, you will feel like you are so alone in this world because you have no baby, you have no family, you have so...
How true
but
they are.
This is my decision, you know. It doesn't mean that I didn't consider all these facts about the future of my decision.
Yeah.
Yeah, your brother Ali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. When we are talking about the duties of a woman in the society and in her own life, it does not mean that we are going to to stop her from being a successful person and entity in the society. No, she can be a successful person and at the same time be a good housekeeper. But being a housewife, a successful housewife, at the same time, for example, like you being a successful physician, it does not necessarily mean that you have to do all the chores in the house. No, you can manage them, for example, in the best way possible. You can divide them between you and your husband. When we are insisting on the concept that, for example, the first and foremost duty of a lady is to be a housewife, it's a matter of upbringing of a human being. Yeah. This is very important, which actually guarantees the survival of generation. So this is important. So if the wife in the house, since, for example, she is a doctor or she is a lawyer or she has a very, let's say, high-ranking position, denies to have, for example, to be a state of to be a housewife. So actually, does it mean really that she doesn't want to create a person in the future? So if this is if the answer is yes to this question, so this is something else that we are really against it. We say that being a housewife does not necessarily mean to limit a wife from all the activities that she is interested in. So she can have all the jobs and, let's say, enjoyments and, let's say, vacancies that she is interested in, at the same time to be a good house of the family, a good mother of the family. Because if we are going to prioritize the duties, so what is of the first and foremost priority for a lady? To give birth, to give life to a child, and to be the center of the house and to actually play the role of a mother. Later, it goes to the second and third and fourth, let's say, ranks that she can think about them. So if we see that some Islamic scholars and even the leader of the Islamic revolution says this, that the woman should take it into account that being a housewife is very important, it does not necessarily mean that she has not to choose or, let's say, select the other jobs as a duty. No, we can't collect between them. We have seen, for example, Lady Fatima salam alayhi, at the same time that she was the housewife for Imam Ali alayhi salam, at the critical times, she came into the society and even she gave lectures and she gave sermons to the Islamic Ummah. I mean, she played the role of political woman at that time in the city-state of Medina. If we consider that environment and we want to transfer it to our today's life, so she could be, for example, a great and high-ranking political lady of the time, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, she was a good mother for Hassanain and Zainabain. So we are taking our role model from her. So this is a lady that we are talking about, like Lady Zainab Salam Allah Aliha. At the same time that she was a teacher before her marriage in Kufa, okay, she was a professional teacher that she was teaching Al-Quran and Tafsir, right? And even at the time of the tragedy of Karbala, she became a nurse at some times. Later, she became a guardian for some. See, the different roles that she has adopted in different levels of her life, so it means that ladies are open to take any responsibility that actually suits them and they are able and capable to do that.
If you allow me, I'll take a more, I think, original, a level before this discussion. Right?
Yeah, I'm over here.
A different approach to this. What really defines the purpose of a thing or a person? For example, you don't use a fridge as a stove, don't you? You don't use a stove as a washing machine. You use each one of these devices for the purposes they were made. They were engineered, right? Likewise, let's look at look at mankind. When God created mankind, both male and female, he created them differently. Male has a different structure than a female does, right? So the question arises, what does this structure entail in the society? If this structure is to be different, why is it different? And if it's different, what responsibilities does each structure hold? Man, and considering the majority of the males in the world, they generally have a more stronger body in terms of their power in enforcing things than a woman. That's why you don't find a woman who is a bricklayer.
Yeah.
Right? Women are normally in more of a soft profession. But when you go to banks or when you go for cooks and stuff, you'll find a lot of female.
This is the part of a speech of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on March 19, 2017. Fatimatu Zahra, God's greetings be upon her, was an Islamic woman. A woman at the highest level of Islamic standards and at the level of a leader. But the same woman who could have been a prophet in terms of spirituality and virtue used to carry out her motherly and wifely duties, and she used to do the housework. These things should be understood. What should one say to these ignorant and deceived individuals? They copy the statements that Westerners make. They should not belittle housework so much. Women's housework means cultivating individuals and producing the best and loftiest product of the universe, that is, humanity. Housework means this, but today our society needs to know what being a mother and a homemaker means. It needs to know what being an excellent homemaker means. With that position and with that status and greatness, Hazrat Fatimatu Zahra was a homemaker. This is not a source of humiliation for her. With that greatness, she cannot be humiliated. Can this greatness be belittled? So her greatness is preserved, but one of the aspects and duties of that greatness was being a spouse, a mother, and a homemaker. We should look at these concepts with such an outlook.
The thing is, you're telling me about some physical features that, is not needed. For example, kind of mental activity. For example, I want to be a novelist, as an example, I want to win the Nobel Prize, but here, this is my brain which is working.
Yeah, Brother Ali mentioned, it's all about priorities. You see, the thing is, your body structure entails a responsibility for you. And in plus this responsibility that you get from this body structure, you also have other responsibilities considering the situation around you. For example, there is no female doctor in the society that you're living in right now, right?
Yeah.
You have that potential to become a doctor. Then it becomes wajibi kifayah, it becomes obligatory on you to become a doctor. This is what Islam is saying. But again, look at the priorities. When you look at woman on itself, not considering other special situations, woman itself has to be the caretaker of the home. as the number one priority, looking at the structure of the woman. The same, likewise, the man has to be the breadmaker of the home as the first priority of the man. But that's why we have to consider both ways.
I know what you mean, but let me tell you something. You are telling me your point of view because, I don't know, you're a man or something. I don't know what is the reason, but every woman, I have to tell you that there is a kind of, I don't know, feeling and atmosphere. Like, for example, if I work outside of the house, I don't know, I'm more powerful, I'm better. And, you know, my mother is a housewife. And, you know, she doesn't work out of the home at all.
Does she have the same thinking?
No, she's really different with me. She's really different with me.
Because you said every woman thinks so.
No, I didn't tell that.
Refer to really. You 1 minute before.
Thank you. Okay. So, I didn't mean to generalize anything, but my mother is a housewife, and she is only in the house, and I know we have a lot of conflict about that, but I have nothing to do with that. But one of, I don't know, my relatives, who is a woman too, which she works outside the house, told her that, oh, you are always in the house. What do you do? What do you do with your time? And, you know, my mother got really upset at that time.
Yeah, because she's devaluing her job.
There is this background between women. Mm-hmm. You are men and you're looking at this, I don't know, phenomena so beautifully, but it's not that much beautiful.
Mm-hmm. No, because you've devaluated it. That's the perception of the society. Unfortunately, this cultural revolution that's happening, industrial revolution, which is making man and woman equal, they look at what man does as, you know, in perfection and what woman does as imperfection. That's not the true thing.
Yeah, I'm not telling that even.
Fulfilling the responsibilities equally are perfect.
Can you measure prosperity? Can you measure happiness? Can you measure generosity? Can that lady actually measure the kind of happiness that your mom has with you at home, with you and your dad and your family?
Exactly, this is what I mean.
So this is not something that she can actually evaluate and measure. That's why she lacks it. And she wants it to actually criticize your mind that, okay, you don't have it. Look, if you are prosperous and if you have happiness, you cannot show it. You can, as at the same time that you cannot show your pain, let's say.
Yeah.
So if you are saying that I'm in pain and my head is aching, I cannot believe you because I'm saying, no, I cannot see the pain in you. So she cannot see the happiness that your mom has while she is at home with you and family and enjoys her life.
So, for example,
the same lady, if you go and check, I don't know if she's criticizing that he's working and she's very happy and she's asking others to go and work. If you go and check and actually scrutinize her life, you will understand that she lacks all those beauties and all those happinesses and prosperity that your mom have.
Yeah, I have to deny this thing because you are telling me that that person was black and my mom was white, but I think all the people are gray. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing is, the thing which I want to tell you is exactly the thing you told me up to here. You are telling me that my mom feels happy with being home, staying home. Okay, this is the way she is.
Okay.
And I am different.
You can be different. Who stopped you from being different?
All the people. You know, you are telling me that. No.
I think what I can express.
No, I want to even encourage you to be outside. I mean, to choose your, I mean, the subject that you have chosen for yourself.
No, let me tell you the problem. All the people think that you can have both. You can have be in the house. You have, I don't know, have husband and so on. But at the same time, you can be a good physician. But this is not what I want. You know, I have more ambition, which I don't want to talk. I talk so personally in this discussion, but I want to do big things. And for doing big things, you have to sacrifice. Yeah,
but what
things.
Makes you think that physician is a big thing, but having taking care of the home is not
this
a big
is personal.
Thing? Yeah, I understand, but no. I'm trying to get back to this point that our perception, our cultural perception, has changed so much after this industrial revolution and this movement of feminism that we perceive what man does as perfection and ideal and better than what woman does, which is not completely true. A man has a responsibility and he has to fulfill that responsibility. Whoever fulfills that the responsibility that person has, whether it be male or female, they are moving towards perfection.
But
as a bread maker of the family, I do my best in doing my bread making, then I've become perfect in that I'm moving towards perfection. And if my wife, for example, she is has a responsibility of a homemaker, right, and she's moving towards that responsibility, fulfilling that responsibility, she's moving towards perfection. Both have the same value when you look at the layer below that. Though the works are different, the tasks are different, what needs to be fulfilled are different, but once it's fulfilled, the values are actually either the same or sometimes, depending on how well it's fulfilled, it's going to be even better.
Thank you for being here with me. Yeah. It was a pleasure. And thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. It was all the time we had for today's episode. I wish you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, accept Al-Habib. Ummati yaquluha lana yawm al-qiyamati. Ummati yaquluha shafa'atan ana laha.
The Limelight.
The U.S. administration is not only unable to fulfill its promises, but also insists on a racist, xenophobic, and repressive view of immigration. And while the number of immigrants entering United States' southern border with Mexico reaches record levels, the treatment of illegal immigrants violates human rights in many cases. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency tells us more. Immigration arrests nearly doubled in 2022 compared to 2021. As border authorities apprehended more migrants and courts blocked the so-called efforts of U.S. President Joe Biden to more narrowly target detentions to focus on serious criminals. According to data released on Friday, 30th of December, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, arrested nearly 143,000 immigrants in the 2022 fiscal year, which ended on 30th of September. Close to double the number in 2021. The data showed around two-thirds of those arrested were of people with only immigration violations. Officials said on a call with reporters most were migrants apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border with no criminal convictions or charges pending and who were transferred to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. At the same time, Immigration and Customs Enforcement deported around 72,000 migrants to more than 150 countries around the world and aided Border Patrol agents in expelling many more from the United States under pandemic-era restriction known as Title 42. Deportation under a statute known as Title 8 is a more formal and drawn-out process that can lead to long bars on U.S. re-entry as compared to expulsions that can take just hours under Title 42, a policy that has been in place since the beginning of the COVID pandemic in March of 2020. U.S. Border Patrol agents apprehended a record 2.2 million migrants at the southwest border in the 2022 fiscal year. Close to half of those arrested were rapidly expelled under the Title 42 policy. Those not expelled are either released into the country to pursue immigration claims or detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. According to Immigration and Customs Enforcement report, more Nicaraguans than any other nationality are currently detained, as migrants from that country are crossing with increasing frequency. Generally, Mexico only accepts the expulsion of some nationalities, mostly Mexicans and Central Americans, and more recently Venezuelans, under Title 42. In 2022, overall, the agency held an average of 22,600 people in custody, with another 321,000 enrolled in an alternative to detention program, which requires released migrants to check in with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. After President Biden took office in January of 2021, his administration issued Immigration and Customs Enforcement guidelines to prioritize the arrest of more serious offenders and de-emphasize enforcement against non-criminals, in contrast to the hardline immigration policies of his predecessor, Donald Trump. CNN News Network has also covered the same story. The U.S. Supreme Court said on Tuesday, 27th of December, that the controversial Trump-era border restriction known as Title 42 will remain in effect while legal challenges play out in courts of law, a move that ensures that federal officials will be able to continue to swiftly expel migrants at U.S. borders at least for the next several months. The 5-4 order is a victory for Republican-led states that urged the Supreme Court to step in and block a lower court opinion that ordered the termination of Title 42. The Biden administration has said it was prepared for the authority to end and had put in place precautions to guard against confusion at the border and any potential surge of migrants. In its order, the court also agreed to take up the state's appeal this term. The court said it would hear arguments on the case during its argument session that begins in February of 2023. Chief Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan said they'd deny the application, but they did not explain their thinking. Conservative Chief Justice Neil Gorsuch also dissented and explained his thinking in an order joined by Liberal Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. Neil Gorsuch said he does not discuss the state's concerns about border security. But Gorsuch noted that Title 42 was put in place to combat COVID-19, and the current border crisis is not a COVID crisis. Chief Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote, "Courts should not be in the business of perpetuating administrative edicts designed for one emergency only because elected officials have failed to address a different emergency." Since March of 2020, Title 42 has allowed U.S. border agents to immediately turn away migrants who have crossed the southern border in the name of COVID-19 prevention. Immigrant advocates and public health experts have long denounced use of public health authority along the U.S. southern border with Mexico, arguing it was an inappropriate pretext for barring migrants from entering the United States. According to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, in nearly 3 years, the authority has been used over 2 million times to turn away migrants. At the border, migrants have been waiting in encampments in Mexico for months, anticipating the end of the authority so they can make their claim of asylum in the United States. Immigrant advocates have tried to disseminate updates and information to migrants, but desperation has grown, especially as temperatures drop. Agence France-Presse has also covered the same story. The decision to uphold a controversial rule known as Title 42 stemmed off a looming political crisis for President Joe Biden, as thousands waited at the southern border with Mexico in expectation the policy was about to end. The U.S. Supreme Court said Title 42, which allows the swift expulsion even of people who might qualify for asylum, would remain in place pending its own ruling on the issue, and that it would hear the case in February of 2023. The court claimed in its 5-4 ruling, 19 states contend that they face an immigration crisis at the border and policymakers have failed to agree on adequate measures to address it. The states suggest the only means left to mitigate the crisis is an order from this court directing the federal government to continue its COVID-era